need my share of the money for a subsidy. They can do it on their own. And it seems a little strange to me that when we write, for instance, laws on land disposal, we give somebody a right to five acres of muskeg and stumps out here and on a home site program, and say you get one in a lifetime, a big deal. You go get you an open to entry or a remote parcel and one every 8 years. And I don't think that it's, and these are things that don't cost, don't take any, they take people's land maybe, but they don't take the people's money. And it seems to me that if, in all good conscience, that if a person is willing to accept a subsidy for a home, and, the rest of the people are willing to see their money used for that purpose, that they should be satisfied with one in a lifetime. But maybe that's too much. One every 7 years, I don't think it's unreasonable. I know when I look around my neighbors, I don't find too many of them buying a new $120,000 house every 3 years or every 7 years. So I have a feeling that what's going to happen is sooner or later, and again, maybe it's just ignorance on my part, but I have a real feeling, Mr. Carney, that that there's not very many of us know what the hell is really happening in this loan business. I know that the figures keep going up year after year after year, and I can use this handy-dandy calculator and say that, we have 200,000 homes in the whole state at 100,000. That's only $20 billion, and you can buy everybody one and give it to them. That should take care of the problem. But I think that if we don't do something to kind of slow the thing down and make it more reasonable, I agree with the testimony was given earlier. Someday we're going to wake up and there's not going to be anything. And I don't think that that's too, and for the benefit of those people that haven't had their chance yet, I don't think it's too much to limit those that have had to waiting another 7 years.
You know, we started, I put seven here and we adopted that and knocked it back to three. That's sort of compromised
with your thoughts on this and everything. That's where we are right now at three. Suppose we can keep talking about it. Go ahead, Pat.
I'm happy with three, but the commission wants us to go back to seven, and I thought that was being taken and considered. I decided that I'd live with three.
Well, why don't we see if there's a motion to change it to seven? If there is, then we can debate it some more.
Chairman.
Representative Malone.
Yeah, I'll move to change it to seven. Mr. Chairman.
Representative Carney's got the floor.
Well, I just want to say that first of all, I'm not convinced, and I would be convinced if someone showed me figures to prove to me that this is being abused. I happen to believe that there's a tremendous need for housing in this state, and that's the reason the demand. People are suddenly realizing, hey, I can afford a house. I don't have to live in a shack or a little old 10-foot-wide trailer anymore. I can afford a house. The payments won't break me. I can finance it. So that's what I think is making the demand. Now, if they can prove to me that it is being abused, I'm willing to reconsider. I don't think that proof is there because I don't think it's happening. And what we're going to do if we put these kind of limitations on the program is make it damn inconvenient for a few people who have to move or want to upgrade, And I don't think that's going to lower the demand. I think it's going to, the demand is going to continue until we reach a level of housing in the state of Alaska that people are satisfied with. And I think the demand will diminish. I had a question about the interest. What is the interest now that they're paying for their loans?
9 and 10.
And we're paying how much the bond?
Probably it'll be 17%.
Well, we're facing a situation where we have a tremendous need for capital, and I'm not so sure that we couldn't use permanent fund money.
That's sort of a separate question.
We're only making, 12-13% on our permanent fund money. It might be that we could get the same return, finance our housing, and not have to build the bond market.
Representative Malone and Montgomery.
Mr. Chairman, the only thing I have to say on the motion is I think that the members of the committee understand the issues that are involved in the motion, and I'm not going to debate it.
Representative Montgomery.
I just asked the commissioner, I appreciate the point, yet I follow along with some of Pat's feelings about upgrading. Is there some other method other than changing it back to seven? Is there a way to speak to both issues? Do you have a suggestion, another way to handle it?
All right, Christian.
Well, there's one way is to move it to seven, and I can understand that. Is there another way, though, to I think, and there is a situation that exists, like Representative Carney said, whereby a young couple, start a family, they get a job, and they buy a $70,000 or $80,000 home, and in 3 years, they start to be successful, they get a promotion, they have a couple of children, and it's obvious they should have a 3-bedroom home, so they want to change it. So I think that's what Pat and I have reference to. Would there be a way the commissioner would suggest that would speak to this and a partial solution?
You can take Representative Adams' chair out. I think he's going to sit there. Commissioner, you want to respond?
I don't have a ready solution, Mr. Chairman. The only other way, it's not going to be a help to these people. To keep
the program under control, keep it from running amok. Would be in fact to allow interest rates to be some sort of discount from what the cost of money is. But immediately, that's going to cause a tremendous frenzy between now and the time of the effective date. But with respect to the point, when I don't think I was unusual growing up, but there were four kids in a 2-bedroom house that my parents had, and it was a long time before they could afford to buy a new one. And we lived in that old one for 15 years. Do people have a right to accelerate that?
I would just add, I agree, and I grew up under the same environment. I know maybe with more kids and less bedrooms, but today there are so many people that are double salaries. The husband and the wife are working, and then and with the inflation, I can see in 3 years or 4 years that there's a temptation to upgrade from a $70,000 to a $90,000 or $110,000 house.
Tom, I raised an issue this morning. Would the governor's position has been one time at the trough, essentially, right? Well, would it be possible to structure it?
In your opinion, as an AHSC board member, would it be possible to structure it in a way that a person gets a $90,000 loan at the time a person wants to upgrade, the maximum loan is the outstanding balance on that first loan, so that over a period of years, a person might turn over the might change housing 10 times, that the amount outstanding of the original state loan just continues to decline. Would that, in your mind, be an acceptable way that wouldn't set an arbitrary, 3 is arbitrary, 7 is arbitrary, 5 is arbitrary, any number we pick is arbitrary, but instead we pick $90,000 subsidized loan from the state that continually declines, so that over, essentially, you get one loan in a 30-year period, but that you can move the loan from house to house. Would that be?
Well, it won't actually work to confine the loan to a 30-year period, because the payment down to principal is much slower in the early part of the loan than in the later part. So if I had it for 3 years, I haven't used up 10% of the principal. Mm-hmm. I was paid back a much smaller amount. So in fact, such a mechanism would stretch out. If I played my cards right there, I probably would make my $90,000 last me for 40 years. Because each time I roll it over, I get a new loan for a 30-year period.
Okay,
I get a loan for 27 years.
It would have to be both amount and term, then, would have to be fixed.
Or alternatively, you could identify what the amount of the subsidy is inherent in the first loan and say the new loan is refinanced. You can come back a second time, but you get your unused subsidy amount. That would ensure that no one... See, the problem is that even if we do 10,000 loans a year, which is $1 billion a year, that's taking care of less than a tenth of the population of the state. And the point is that until everybody has at least had a chance to share in the wealth that the subsidy represents to those who are in the good fortune of being able to borrow, they shouldn't be allowed to come back a second or a third time. That's the basic problem.
Do you think there's a way that subsidy limitation could be carried forward in law that would be
administratively possible? I don't want to create huge difficulties. A 3-year rule is real easy for AHSC to enforce. I'm wondering, in terms of carrying forward subsidy, that might not be as easy.
It's more cumbersome, yes, it would be.
Representative Metcalf.
Commissioner, have you run the numbers on the cash flow profitability of turning over a house in 3 years, 4 years, or any number to show that this is somehow profitable for someone to do this? In other words, I'm trying to determine by what basis you determined there was an incentive, cash incentive, to turn over a house in a short period of time.
Okay. No, I don't. I haven't actually put pencil to paper. It's more of a proposition of logic.
I know where wags get me in the real estate business. I think that you ought to put a pencil to this. And I think that you will come to the same conclusion that I have. There's just no money in it. Turning over a house in 3 years, that's where it starts to get marginal. Pull your cash out and turn it over. 4 years, maybe. 5 years, probably.
At 25% appreciation?
You put a pencil to it and check your closing costs and so on and so forth, it's marginal.
Any other discussion on the motion?
Mr. Chairman, can I make one further comment? I think that yesterday the committee was talking about requiring a due on sale clause to ensure a turnover to improve the bond market. Now you're doing the reverse. You're saying you're providing a disincentive to a turnover.
The two issues may relate, but not on that point, I don't believe. The due on sale means that when it's sold, and it's likely to be sold sometime between 7 and 12 years, that the investor is paid off.
But I guess the point that I'm trying to make here is that if you buy a house and you hold it for 7 years, you have X amount of a subsidy. But if you hold it 3.5 years and then you adjust to the new market rate of interest, you're going to have a similar amount of subsidy, but if the rate of interest has gone up, it's going to be less. So it's basically going to be the state's advantage to have somebody turn a house over in 3.5 years.
Depends on what the interest rates do.
As opposed to holding the same house for 7.
Any other discussion on the motion, Representative Carter?
Well, I think Ray made a good point, and that is that there's no one who knows, if I'm not mistaken, no one really knows that this abuse is occurring or necessarily that it is that profitable. I know that there's closing costs, a lot of closing costs and commissions involved in houses, and I don't believe the kind of a thing that is being abused or happening. So I just, if someone can show me figures to prove it, hey, I'm willing. But when he talks about a $90,000 house have been the average price of a house a year ago, and now it's up to 120, I'm wondering what's going to happen to these young people who want houses if no one can move out of the ones that are $90,000 now.
Mr. Chairman.
Good.
I don't want to protract the debate, but let me offer my own personal experience. I bought a condominium in Anchorage 2 years before I was appointed commissioner, and I paid $71,500 for it. And when I was appointed commissioner, I had to move to Juneau because that's where my workstation is. I sold it for $76,000. After the commissions, I lost money. I had closing costs and commissions that came to about $6,000. So I had $70,000 net on a $71,500 investment. The condominium next door was for sale last month for $89,000. Now, I dare say that if I had kept it for these 2 years, I would be making money.
What's the rate of inflation for 2 years?
I don't think you can account for a 20% rise simply by the rate of inflation.
Not all. Not all of that. A good chunk of it.
Question.
Those in favor of the motion to change it from 3 years to 7 years, or again? Changing it to 2.7.
Change it to 7. No. I just didn't ask any questions.
Mr. Chairman, I didn't mean to trigger it, such a protracted debate on that. What I really wanted simply to say was that I thought Section 3 was an improvement over its counterpart.
Okay, we did take out the or to the spouse business.
Right.
Okay, now the remaining question on the AHSC bill is the multifamily section that you'll find in a two-page amendment here. The couple of suggestions that were offered by Mr. Miles from the AHSC. Oh, Mr. Williams, there was one other question here I wanted to take care of on this whole question, and that was the cutoff date. Now, Representative from AHSC suggested that we say that this does not apply to mortgage loans which the corporation has committed to purchase prior to September 1, 1981. So that would mean that September 1, 1981 is the cutoff. And there's been some suggestion on committee that ought to be immediate or upon the effective date of the act. What's your suggestion on that?
Well, my recommendation would be to make it sooner rather than later, because you may well, since there's a period there where it's essentially olly olly in free, everybody who can get a loan before the 1st of September won't be tagged by this, it will artificially heighten the demand for AHSC financing.
That's my feeling too. So I'd move that we have an immediate effective date on this section. Is there any discussion? Ask unanimous consent. Hearing no objection. Milt, did you get that?
No, sir.
Okay. The suggestion by AHFC was not adopted, so this business about the 7-year wait, it takes effect upon the effective date of the act, immediately or whatever day that the bill passes, or whatever the effective date on the bill is. Okay? Okay.
Yeah.
Right, right. I think the intent of the committee, though, is to as soon as this bill passes, that's when the clock starts. If they had a loan the day before the bill passes, they can get a loan the day after the bill passes. But once they take the loan after this bill passes, they can't get another one for 7 years.
To do that, we need to change the language.
Right. Well, so, but that's the intent of the committee, and if Milt comes up with the right language, that's what we want, right? Representative Rogers.
So anybody who got a loan from the program over the last several years gets two dips at the trough?
Basically, yeah.
Oh, okay. That's not the way I read the language, and I think Milt is right. The way it says now, if you have gotten a loan in the last 7 years, you're not eligible until 7 years after you received that loan. And I think that's fair.
Okay, well.
Changing the rules.
Basically changing the rules. But I think my motion was that it was a cutoff starting at this point in time. Okay. Yeah, that's been a long time.
Are we talking about the 7-year provision again?
Yes.
It would go into effect on the effective date of the bill, that wouldn't be retroactive with respect to those people already purchased homes under the program.
That's what I had in mind, yeah. I'm not, I'm open for discussion. I didn't mean to rush the amendment through that. Anybody know what I'm doing?
About the 7-year provision again?
Yes.
It would go into effect on the effective date of the bill, that wouldn't be retroactive with respect to those people who already purchased homes under this program.
That's what I had in mind, yeah. I'm not, I'm open for discussion. I didn't mean to rush the amendment through that. Anybody know what I'm doing?
I just want to understand.
Sam, would you mind repeating what you said? I was reading and not.
Okay. The question is, when should this provision take place or take effect? Now, or should it be retroactive?
Well,
In other words, if you got a loan 5 years ago, if this bill passed, would you have to wait an additional 2 years? Or the way I proposed it was that if this bill passed, that's when the clock started ticking. From that point forward, you can only get one loan every 7 years. And that's the motion I made, that these new provisions wouldn't start until this bill passed. And there's an objection and a discussion. Mr. Meekins.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I support your motion, and the reason is that I think I can see both sides of it, but it really wouldn't be fair to the people that determined making a decision on, you know, when you buy a home, you try to take into consideration everything. And at the time that people take that into consideration, there wasn't such a rule that you couldn't go back. And so that may have affected one of the most crucial decisions that any people ever make in terms of their own personal finance, their own personal life. They may not have opted to purchase at that time and said, well, if we only do it once, maybe let's wait until we get our dream home, as opposed to this one that's sort of a, you know, the first step, and then we're going to be in this little one, and we don't want to pay rent, we'll do this one now, and then we'll sell it later and go into the home that we really want. And I think that it might have really affected some decisions, at least during that 7 year period. Of course, they could always wait to 7 years, but I don't mind putting a constraint on, but it seems not fair to put it on retroactively and change the rules that people work under.
Representative Carney.
Of course it's fair to put it on retroactively. In the first place, these people who already have loans have been abusing the program. It's obvious from the commissioner's testimony that we've had a lot of abuse. So we're going to let them come back to this trough again, you know? And that's bullshit in the first place, so they aren't abusing the program, you know? But if the logic that makes us go to 7 years is true, then it's more logical to cut those people out than it is the people in the future.
That's not my the logic I'm using is that people will now have to make a decision on whether they want to enter this program now or at a later time, and they'll make it for the purpose of deciding on the kind of housing they want, not on the basis of whether or not it's a good investment to make to get a loan at this time.
Mr. Chairman, I guess my concern is I don't think the argument of changing the rules applies here, in that last year was when we changed the rules, and anyone who bought a loan previously to last year was operating under the rules that it wasn't a subsidized loan. And it may be fair, you know, it may be fair to make, not to go back the whole 7 years, but go back to when the state started subsidizing the loans and say that you only get one subsidized loan. The subsidized loan started a year ago with the program. Prior to that, it was done with the state was not putting that kind of money in. And it seems to me that those who've gotten a subsidized loan in the past year, to say that group may get a second subsidized loan, but nobody else can, is unfair. I think anyone who received a loan from AHSC during the years that it was done with tax-exempt financing probably should be able to get a subsidized loan these days, but not the other way around.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I will support the amendment, but I think there is a practical problem in that if we don't make it retroactive for some period of time, then there will be, there may be some increase in the number of the requests for commitments for HFC financing just due to the fact that they get in under the wire, then, you know, they may get another loan pretty quick.
Both arguments are good, but I'm going to support the amendment.
Representative Carney's next.
Well, I'd like to make a very serious request, and that is that someone provide me with information to prove that this flagrant abuse has been occurring, because if they don't, I'm prepared to try to change this on the floor.
Okay, well, I think that's fair enough. I mean, this is a question that's it's a pretty big issue, so I don't think it'd be improper or immoral if you'd offer an amendment on the floor. I don't think it's just a matter of abuse. I think it's a matter of people being able to take advantage of the program under the restraints that we're going to eventually have to be operating under. And that's how much money are we willing to dump into this to this program. I suppose that there may or may not have been some abuses. That's not what's guiding me on this issue. Representative Meekins is next.
Mr. Chairman, I'd agree that both sides on this argument have a good case. I mean, I've been persuaded that at least it's a reason we could disagree on it. But a couple of points. One is that making it retroactive, just as an interesting point, sounds to me exactly what Ullman did with his bill. So it's almost the same thing, you know. So I don't know if how I think about that because of that. But in terms of the abuse, you know, perhaps it's been abused from some sort of objective criteria, but we're the ones that set up the program, and we defined, you know, that everybody in the world could go do this, and they could do it as much as they want, and there was somehow a priority of the state to put $600 zillion into loans and to keep the economy going. I think it definitely has helped the economy. Nobody can deny that. So we made that decision as a policy judgment, and the public isn't abusing it, even if they used it 10 times. We're the ones that set up the program. And, you know, unless we had said that you can't do it, they're not abusing it. They're just using it. They're using a program that we set up for them because of a need that maybe we conjured up or maybe it was real, but they're just doing it. So I don't know that you're giving people that have already abused it an extra benefit because I think they're just using it. You want to change the rules because that wasn't a good idea and we were stupid. Well, you can change it, but I don't know that you want to exact a penalty on people just because they used the program that we set up so they could use it. I mean, we wanted them to use it. We set it up so they could.
Representative Rogers.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I guess I'm persuaded in part by that, and I'd move an amendment to your amendment, which would make the effective date May 21st, 1981. That loans made after that date would be subject to a 7-year limitation. That's today.
I think Representative Carney was next. I just want to make sure you understood that I did make a formal request for the information.
From the commissioner, right?
Yeah. Some documentation to prove that
people have been turning over homes to get the benefit of these 2 or 3 years in subsidies. So that I won't, if he can convince me, if he can show me figures, then I won't have another word to say about subsidies.
Okay, Representative Malone.
Mr. Chairman, I concur in the remarks offered by Representative Meekins. Even if somebody has been buying and selling homes at the rate of 5 a month, you know, it's hard. You might say that's a little extreme, but you know, we don't have anything that says that's an abuse right now. And I don't think that's what the argument turns on. The argument turns on, you know, how, you know, that the program's costing a lot of money and we're trying to provide housing. It seems like if somebody already has a house that they got under the program, that they're in pretty good shape, maybe that somebody else that didn't get one yet might, maybe should be line ahead of them. But in the amendment that's being offered, I don't know how administratively the corporation could resolve applications that were received between the effective date set out in the amendment and the effective date of the bill. It seems to be a lot of people there that you know, the only thing they could do would be to notify them that the legislature may, in effect, turn down their loan. Then again, they may not. So I think that it would be, it'd create a lot of uncertainty, and if I understand the amendment correctly.
No.
Can I ask you a second here? Do you have something that fits in right here that is Haugen and then Moss?
Yeah, I wanted to explain the amendment. The amendment would be that for anyone who receives a loan after today, that they may not receive another loan for the next 7 years.
So, regardless of what they did in the past.
Representative Haugen.
I'm going to raise a question just the opposite of that. Have the banks got a waiting list on anticipation?
In our case, Representative Hogan, we have probably about $12 million just sitting there in forms of application that have never been submitted. The last few years, if I can make it.
Representative.
There may be some people who have previously had an Alaska housing law.
Certainly.
I don't know. Yes.
Did you have something to add on that?
Just to point out a little clearer, the problem that may lie there is an individual that
had just put down earnest money yesterday on a home, expecting to get it financed through Alaska Housing, and it, you know, would normally take 4 weeks or 4 or 5 weeks possibly for it to come over to Alaska Housing. He may, if the rules are going to be different at that time that it comes over to the corporation, he may have elected not to put that earnest money down, and depending on how that agreement is written up, he may be out that, he decided to change his mind, he may be out that earnest money agreement that you get a seller and a buyer that, that will be affected by it.
Good, boss.
Mr. Chairman, I want to get something where I can understand about this report that we asked out of the commissioner over there. About those people who have used this loan program in order to turn them over and so forth. Aren't we asking an impossible thing? Because how do you know what a guy intended to do? I mean, if we just want to know how many people had a loan and then only kept it a year, maybe, but how do we know his intent was to grab another one? I think we're asking an impossible task.
We'll see what he comes up with, I guess. I think it is some pretty vague information that was.
I don't know what use it'll be to us after we get it.
Well, perhaps you'll come up with something that is useful, and I think that's what Representative Carney's asking for. It would be nice to see some sort of documentation that would relate to what possible abuses may have taken place. If there's something there, fine. If there's not, and then he'll turn it in a blank sheet of paper, I suppose.
Well, I might make one other comment then. We were talking about 3 years and 7 years and all this crap. It's a subsidized loan, and maybe we ought to just say one time in their life, and that's it, period, because we're trying to introduce somebody into a new home. I don't know. Maybe that's the way it ought to be done. I think that was the original intent in the first place, but subsidized interest money.
Representative Mick.
Mr. Chairman, I would think that the real estate people would be very aware of any kind of abuse of this nature. I just kind of quickly ran through some numbers here to show the absurdity of the suggestion that somebody's going to do this for a profit. Now, let's put what the commissioner said in perspective. 4 years ago, he paid $71,500 for a house that's now worth $89,000, or an apparent profit of $17,500. But he left out the following facts. In the original purchase, he paid an additional approximately $3,000 in closing costs in order to facilitate the transaction of a $71,500 purchase. When he sold it, if he were to have held it for the 4 years at $89,000, he would have paid in the proximity of $5,500 in closing in commissions, which he said he didn't pay commissions. In addition, he would have paid approximately $2,500 in seller's closing fees, closing costs, for a total going in and going out of the deal, $11,000. Okay, so you take that away from your apparent profit of $17,500, leaves you $6,500. Now, assuming you want to upgrade, you're looking at a closing cost going in into a more expensive home of around $4,000. So that leaves you, of your $6,500 cash, actual cash realization, $2,500 over and above that, that then you can apply to the down payment of a 10% down payment on a cash loan to your new purchase and your upgrade. So if you put it in perspective, it just doesn't work.
I'm not going to argue with his numbers and not going to argue whether or not there's abuse. But I think the important point is to try to slow down the frenzy of demand for this program. And I think a lot of the demand for this program is not a demand for better housing, but a demand for cheap money. And it happens to be that the cheapest money in town is Alaska Housing Finance's money. And for someone who owns a home and has a fair equity position in it, the best place to get cheap money is to move. And that's the advantage of AHSC, and that's the reason to try to limit a person from taking advantage of that too many times. And I think that's a good reason to put the seven-year rule in. I think that will make people think before they jump in and grab the cheap money. The demand is not...
not all of the demand is for housing. A lot of the demand is for the cheapest money in Alaska.
Mr. Chairman. I point out that if we're worried about it, fixed dates and all that crap around here, we're going to have to change it again before we finish working with this bill, aren't we?
Well, I just think that I think there's a lot of logic in favor of making it retroactive just because people weren't aware. I doubt that the same argument that makes me think that we shouldn't put the 7-year limitation makes me believe that people who bought in the past didn't buy on the basis of whether or not they could turn it in 7 years. So I think that the logic is that if people have taken advantage of the program, and if we decide that it's going to be a policy decision that you can only do that once every 7 years, then I think it should apply equally to those in the past as it does to those in the future.
I guess there's an argument for that. I think that I buy Minkin's argument that you shouldn't change the rules in the middle of the game on an issue like this, but tell you what, we're not going to finish the bill today. There's a budget and audit committee meeting here at 4:30, so I will preciously lay the issue on the table as to the date of cutoff on this thing. And how's that?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Freeman's not here, but everyone else is. Perhaps we could vote and lay it on the table that way.
Well, there's a suggestion to go with May 21st. I think there's a couple of technical problems with that. I'd prefer to leave that as a decision we can make tomorrow morning.
Mr. Chairman, I'll withdraw my motion, and you can withdraw yours.
I withdraw mine. Okay. I would like to get into the one of the remaining issues on the bill, though, and that's the multifamily financing. Representative Buckle?
Is that the only remaining issue on the bill?
On the housing bill, yeah. On the housing portion of the bill. There's a couple other issues on housing, I guess, but this is one of the major ones that really hasn't been addressed by the committee.
Chairman, I got an amendment I'd like to make to that. Maybe I can get it in now and get it over with.
Okay, let me just run through what we got. How's that? Okay, basically, right now, and there's some suggestion to just go to ADA instead of HFC, but let's try it here, and if the issue, if it sails, then we can later decide whether it goes to ADA or HFC. How does that sound? The special mortgage program, the proposal is to expand it to include financing after completion of construction of new rental multifamily residences of more than two units in rural or urban areas. And I think that what Moss's motion is going to be to just take out the distinction between the two and just say that it's a program that can operate either place. And there's the limits that are described in the following sections that say how much money you can spend on it. There again, you've got different limits for rural and urban. And then you get down to the question of urban and rural. Okay. At the present time, there's no definition of urban or rural in the statutes. It's done by regulation. And the motion by Mr. Moss would be to delete sections 5 and 6, which... Well, that's not section 5 and 6. It's line 16 through 19 on page 2. And it would be my intention to include language that would require the corporation to make loans, be they rural or urban, consistent with the standards in the special mortgage purchase program. That is 9% for veterans and 10% for all others. Representative Rogers.
Mr. Chairman, can someone tell me how much this amendment costs?
Well, the amendment, it would be my intention to require special appropriation for however much we would like to put into this program. Understand what I'm saying?
Well, yeah, I understand what you're saying, but, you know, here we are, we're wrestling with trying to limit the amount of demand for a program in one, pushing it down in one place and then just opening it up wide open in another area. And as I recall, the testimony was that to take care of demand, you're talking about $200 to $250 million in state subsidy for a $400 to $500 million program. And you're saying, well, we're going to try to limit that by only appropriating X. So that means that we're going to handle part of the demand. And I don't believe that we're going to be able to come back in next year and say, well, we're handling about 25% of this, and the other 75% of you have to go to ADA and pay market rates, but the first 25%, the first group of people who comes in gets a 9 and 10% rate. Mr. Chairman, I just don't see that we'll be able to limit it to the amount of appropriation any more than AHFC has been limited by the amount of its appropriation. So I'd object to this whole amendment.
Representative Meekins.
Chairman, is there any specific person or group that supports this amendment?
Representative Miller and Representative Hayes expressed strong interest and asked me to consider multifamily financing. I'm not necessarily pushing it or opposed to it. I don't think it's a, I think it's probably a good idea because some areas of the state do have a very low vacancy rate, like you know, and it's not considered by some to be non-profitable to build apartment houses, and so this was one effort to increase the number of units available for people to live in this case it happened to be apartments. So I think there's some good arguments on both sides of it.
Mr. Chairman, the second question is at one point in discussions only on this, I heard people talk about regulating it based upon vacancy rate. I don't see that in here. I think I'm remembering that correctly.
Well, that was a discussion at one point, but that was taken out because of the ability of the corporation to allocate it on a regional basis. I think one of the reasons people were interested in the vacancy rate factor was so that not all of it would go into one area of the state. And as long as they were able to regionally allocate the funds, people that were interested seemed pretty satisfied to leave that vacancy rate factor out.
Mr. Chairman, the only problem I have with that is that Representative Rogers' comments, I think, do have some merit to them. I don't know the actual facts, but at least hypothetically, they have some merit, possibly. And if you had it limited by vacancy rate, then you know there'd be a finite limit to it because not every area of the state would be eligible. You could adjust the rate up and down to do that, just in the most crucial areas. On the other hand, if you have an allocation, then once you burn up your allocation, then you've got a whole other group of people that potentially, anyway, unless you fully fund the whole thing, are sitting out there under a different set of facts and. That's not fair, and so then the pressure is to open it up. And so if we're going to do that, we got to know how far we're going. And one of the reasons I was concerned before about how much it was going to cost is because I thought you could control it by, you know, this is how much we got for this program, and just jack the vacancy rate down until you get to that point. And just you're only hitting the very most crucial areas of the state, and you're only just doing a little bit for them. So that's just a concern I have. I don't know where that leads to.
More than anything else, I'm laying this on the table for the consideration of the committee. I'm not a strong advocate nor opponent of the idea. I think there are some problems with it, but I also think it is an answer to some of the concerns raised by especially Representative Miller for this town.
And Mr. Chairman, I do agree with you that those problems are pretty ironic if we're taking care of all sorts of other things, and yet for people that are just trying to find a place to rent, that's under $1 million, they can't do it in some of these communities, and they don't have enough money to buy a house, but we haven't provided, you know, for the people that are a lower income that don't qualify for the purchases. So I agree with you that, and agree with Representative Miller, that it's a need that we should address. I'm just concerned with knowing what we're biting off when we go in.
Just a second, I want to ask Milt a question here. There's been a lot of sentiment to put this program, if we're going to do multifamily, let ADA do it. It's a business venture. It's not a residential venture. Let ADA take care of it, and let perhaps ADA can come up with, I think that you were saying that they can sell a bond, and 10% of the bond could be used for something that wasn't bondable, like multifamily housing. And I know that the Senate Bill 404, this includes in the eligible categories, include multifamily housing. Is that, in your opinion, a viable alternative to complicating the AHFC program?
Well, I believe it would be. Again, we should check with the bond council on that. But if they do a $400 million program, you would have $40 million to be used for that purpose. Actually, I suspect the standalones, you would not be able to take out into that 10%, it's probably only the umbrella bonds that you can do that. And so it might be only about $20 million.
Well, the interest seemed to be around in the $10 million neighborhood as far as you. And if we put it in here, I think that people are going to be satisfied with about $10 million for the entire program. So in that case, is it your opinion that we could easily take care of it by making the appropriate changes in the ADA statutes?
Yes, sir. I think that's definitely possible.
Representative Rogers.
I'd like to ask, I guess, Mr. Coyner, if the banks now are making loans for four apartment buildings.
Would that be deferred to Mr. Sullivan again?
Okay.
No, Representative Rogers. I speak for my own bank personally, but common knowledge or general knowledge, no, this is not being done.
Okay. Because the interest rates are too high?
Because fundamentally, interest rates are too high, and the rents necessary to debt service are too low.
They simply will not pencil, and they are not economically feasible under today's interest rate scenario.
Through ADA, do you think that would provide an adequate...
original limitation of no residential on industrial revenue bonds, and if you further subvert this, I don't know what this may precipitate as far as Congress is concerned. So it's a difficult question to answer.
Well, in your opinion, should we get into the apartment business through subsidized loans through HFC?
If you'll accept this as a personal opinion, and not representative of anything else, and with all due respect to Representative Metcalf, the answer is no at this time.
What was the question?
What was the question?
The question is, should we do this?
It was such a good answer, I wanted to hear the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Does anybody on the committee have a different opinion about whether this ought to go into AHFC? Do you have a different opinion about whether this ought to go into AHFC?
Yeah, I do.
Do you think it should, huh?
I'd like to pose the question to Mr. Sullivan.
Look, no, Jay, it's on this question,
yes, I
go
do.
Ahead.
I think if we don't take care of the apartment situation, if we don't address apartments.
I'm talking about in AHFC now.
Okay, ADA, under ADA's program.
Okay, I'm going to cut you off here because we're going to have to leave here in a couple minutes.
Under ADA's program, they can go down to approximately 8 plexes. That's going to leave the disparity from 7 plexes down to 2 plexes. I think that if nothing else, this program should take up to 7 units.
Anybody in the committee think so?
And,
okay, look, we got about, I'm going to cut it off right at 4:30. Budget Nod is going to move in, so we're here for 5 or 6 more minutes. But on the housing now, let me make sure I got this right. I think the other big part of decision on the housing is, and is William still here? No. Okay, it's the amount of money we want to allow the corporation, the amount of bonds we want to authorize the corporation to sell. The legislative finance recommends 492, AHFC recommends 592. What's the recommendation from the committee?
Okay, by me. How much more does that cost us in
According to AHFC, nothing more, right? We just authorized them to sell up to $592 million.
That is correct. If bonding authorization doesn't cost you a dime, the
the only thing that it increasing it from 492 to 592 the higher does is prevent us from having to come back to you in the event that subsidy funds are sufficient for the fiscal year, but the bonding authorization is not.
So you still might come back to us for more subsidy funds either way.
Pardon me?
You still might come back to us for more subsidy funds, regardless of whether it's 492 or 592, right?
I think it would depend on our philosophy on us, whether and your intent in subsidy funding and bonding authorization is this is the program for a full year. I believe we will not come to you others' names.
Well, I think that's an important point because there's no reason that we shouldn't allow you to go to 592 if you can do it for no extra money, right? Obviously. But what might happen is you prepare a bond issue going up to 590, you know, that it may not be that large, but it completes the 592, then you come to us and say, well, look, we don't have enough subsidy to run this program, and we're just waiting here ready to go to the bond market. We need 50 million or something, right? Which might be okay, but I don't want you to do that, you know. I think that if you're saying you just want it because you think you can leverage that good and get up to 592 somehow with the available revenue, that's great. But let's not make this the decision as to how much subsidy we want in there. You know what I'm saying? I hope you follow me. Right, I understand that. So I would certainly think we should do it, and I'm not saying I'd be opposed to you coming back sometime or something, conditions change. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying let's not make that decision a function of this one. They're separate. You know? Don't leverage us, too.
Representative Haugen and Rogers.
How many units is this going to provide?
We anticipate the average loan amount
of
$92.5.
About 9,000.
9,000 units.
I think of 9.
Yeah,
9,500. What do you say? Okay. Yeah, Representative Rogers.
Yeah, it's just the switch of exactly 100 from 492 to 592 seems kind of curious. 492 is exactly 41 million a month, so that seems to me that might have been. But to switch to 592. I mean, why 592 and not 600?
It's just an additional cushion. We felt that an additional cushion of 100 million would be sufficient.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, I'd move 592 then. Is there any objection to that?
Why not 600? 600.
Move 600.
$8 million, I mean, you're rounding it off. I know it's a small number.
592 sounds good to me.
Well, Mr. Chairman, there's really no reason to give an upper limit as long as it's not costing us any more money. So even though you're going up another $8 million, there's no reason to be against that unless it's going to mean that we have to come up with more money. If they think they can be more efficient because of interest changes or something else or cash flow.
Or any limit.
Really the only reason for a limit is so that the legislature can stop the program if it decides that it doesn't like it. That's the only reason that it's there.
Well, let's not argue about $8 million here. So, does it make any difference, really?
No, it doesn't.
Anybody object to 592?
Go ahead.
All right.
That's enough.
Okay, now, are there other questions remaining on the home loan program? There's one question. We'll come in tomorrow morning. There's going to be, I promised, a hearing on Senate Bill 18 tomorrow morning first. That shouldn't take, that'll be at 9 o'clock. So we'll just take this up at 8:30. And try to decide the question on when this 7-year period starts, the clock starts ticking on that. I think Rogers had one more amendment.
Yeah, it was
alternative
about
energy
on whether or not they could reduce the amount of eligibility for a loan based on an alternative energy loan being made on a dwelling. And I'll make that one tomorrow. I've got a copy ready.
Are there other housing loan questions that people think need to resolve? Representative Carney?
I still have a problem with the lack of ability to assume, and I'm scratching my head and wondering if there's some way that if we're not going to allow people to come back to trough for 7 years, that maybe there's some way we can slide an assumption in there so that somebody else can pick up their spot at the trough and they can move over some way. Yeah. I don't know. Just a thought. But I would like to reconsider the wording in Section 3 about assumption.
Okay. Well, then there's going to be some ADA questions here, and we'll try to see if the multifamily question can be resolved there. 8:30 in the morning. One of these days we're going to meet at Senate Bill 18 and the prime sponsor, Senator Fahrenkamp. Welcome to the Finance Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 18 is a simple bill and yet a far-reaching bill. I think it's rather self-explanatory. It offers some summer school program for our special children during this summer. If you will notice, it has an effective date, also a date when it sunsets. The reason for that, I was a member of the Special Ed Task Force, and we did not wish to in any way interfere with the task force recommendations for special education. However, for the past 3 years, as I have worked on this bill, it's gotten involved with a larger bill and been lost, and I didn't want to take that chance this year. The bill offers this summer for any student who is emotionally, mentally, physically, or multi-handicapped summer session, and each individual school district is eligible to apply for the funding for this program. The reason that it, I have one problem with that, though, that was brought to my attention this morning, and that is that dysgraphia and dyslexia is not included. So the committee might want to consider adding Section D to line 13, page 1, of course, where it says A, B, C, and F, adding Section A, B, C, D, and F. The question came up then, would that affect the physical note? I seriously doubt that, since the physical note takes into consideration every child who is now in the program of all four of the categories listed everywhere in the state. And this late in the year, the chances of every child in every school taking part are very slim. Mr. Chairman, these children are children who regress a great deal during the summer. And I urge, I'll answer any questions you have, but I think the bill is rather self-explanatory, and I just urge its passage. It needs to be done quickly because the school year is out in many places this week.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator, would we also need to add a D on line 21?
Yes, you would.
Okay, and I'm a little concerned. I know we need to get this going, but the fiscal note wouldn't take effect until the budget year begins. Is that a problem?
No, we thought it might be. But in discussing this with the Commissioner of Education, the first payment of the teachers, et cetera, who arranged for in this program would not come about until the 1st of July anyway. That would be the first payday. So his answer was that there would be no problem since the money would be effective on the 1st of July and the first paycheck is on the 1st of July, that it would not slow down the program.
Chairman, Representative Rogers. Finance statement. I personally would like to include all of the exceptional children in 350, including the gifted children. However, I don't want to bog down the bill and will not move that, but I think it's important that that we do handle the needs of all exceptional children.
Mr. Chairman, there is a Senate bill and a House bill that comes from the recommendation of the Special Ed Task Force on which I served that we're hopeful we'll have through this both bodies this coming year.
While we're at it, I wanted to talk a little bit about Senate Bill 365 and House Bill 449. Were you the prime sponsor of 365? Is that right?
I'm one of the sponsors.
Yeah.
Senator Stimson is the prime sponsor, according to the listing.
Well, and I know that they're similar subjects, but
One of the main differences is that, of course, this only establishes a one-year-only summer program, whereas the other bills provide for a change in the formula funding for the entire school year. And secondly, this one costs $2 million and the other one costs $19 million. That's the second consideration, of course. And I've had a chance to read your article in the Fairbanks, I guess the Alaska Weekly. And there's been a lot of interest expressed in House Bill 449, which is in this committee, and some of the way I've been answering the question is I'm saying, well, we'll probably go ahead and do Senate Bill 18, the summer program, and then reassess the other proposals next session. Of course, we could, I suppose, go ahead and maybe amend Senate Bill 18 to do a more comprehensive program, and that would be available to us as far as a vehicle is concerned. Do you have any comments along those lines?
Mr. Chairman, I'm fully supportive of the larger program, but I'm also practical, and I feel that our chances of getting that program done without more thorough study and work on it from members of both bodies are very slim this year, and I'd hate, like everything, to see this program held up another year for the fourth year when these kids really need the attention and digress so much during the summer months. And I certainly pledge my full support and hard work on that for the coming year.
I share your opinion on that. Also, it was brought to my attention by you, as a matter of fact, that this bill, there's probably a critical time factor involved, and that's one of the reasons why, instead of working on a couple of the House bills we're trying to finish up, we went ahead and took this up. And you've mentioned that some of the school districts aren't going to be able to take to do this program because we've waited so long, but most of the school districts will be able to take advantage of this. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, they will. They have been notified both by our office and by the Department of Education that the chances of this bill is good and to be prepared, so that many of the school districts are geared up, are ready to go. There are some who are not. They were a little more apprehensive, perhaps.
Representative Rogers.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I concur with you. I support House Bill 449, Senate Bill 365, but I don't think the two issues should be combined into a single bill. And of the two, I think it's more important to get Senate Bill 18 right now so we don't have the backsliding during the summer, the regression in abilities. And it's more important that we get a good year-round program going now, and then hopefully at a later date we can upgrade that program.
Mr. Chairman, the Senate bill and House bill that are the more inclusive special ed bills would not be able to be put into effect until the coming school year. So even though we were to pass both of those bills, their effective date, if you notice, was July 1 as well, and we'll make this bill moot, but their chances of gearing up for a program of that size at this stage of the game would be almost impossible for the school districts.
Representative Buchholz.
Senator Fahrenkamp, in your fiscal note, it stated here that the population covered under this fiscal note would be about 25% of the kids under special ed. Is that true?
I have a breakdown. Yes, it is.
Okay, then my concern is this. You know, there are quite a number of children in this category, and how would you select which ones you would favor to participate in this program?
We selected them by their classification within the programs.
Okay. Now, what happens if everyone, just about everyone, wants to participate in this program? I know how they regress in the summertime. How are you going to deal with that problem?
All I can do is pray that school districts are ready since they've been notified, and the budget covers, the budget's written in case every child who falls in those categories does take part.
Would this budget, Mr. Chairman, would this budget include transportation?
Yes. Well, it's that's yes and no. No, it doesn't. It's not listed in the cost. the school district felt that the transportation, the way the transportation system is set up, that it could be covered, or would be covered.
We don't have the contract out, especially for the summer session.
That's my understanding.
Okay, because I know this is a major issue.
I can't
pick them up from their front yard
and
take them home, because they can't manage otherwise. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Are you ready for a motion on the bill, Mr. Chairman?
We'll do that. Probably, I'd like to get a motion on the amendment to add Section D on lines 13 and 21. Did you have something, Representative Montgomery?
No. Okay. No, I was.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that on page 1, line 13 and line 21, after C, comma, add paren D, paren, comma.
Okay. Is there any objection to that motion? Is there anyone here that is anyone else that wanted to testify this morning? I didn't mean to run you off there, Betty. Please come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Steve Hall from the Department of Education. The department certainly has no objection to adding those students defined in subsection D. However, I would draw to your attention that it would substantially increase the fiscal note, because the bill is put together based upon the amount of money those youngsters generate during the school year under the formula. So they would be subject to the same formula as would the other kids covered in the bill. So the cost would go up just by virtue of the number of youngsters.
Okay, let's talk about numbers then. If we include, let's see, mentally retarded, physically handicapped, emotionally handicapped, and multiple handicapped, the department's prepared a fiscal note that approaches almost $2 million. And how many people are you talking about when you give us, you know, the original fiscal note without the inclusion of D? How many?
Well, our best guess is that about 25% of the special education population fall within those categories. And
what's the number?
That's roughly 4,000.
So you're saying,
excuse me, 3,000.
3,000 is 25%?
Roughly.
So there's about 12,000.
Yes, sir.
Statewide.
The great majority of that 12,000 is in that section that you're adding.
The biggest majority is?
Yes, sir. Those are learning disabled, the speech impaired, hearing impaired. What we typically refer to as the levels 1 and 2 youngsters.
Okay, so we're talking about 3,000 kids if we do 25% of the 12,000. If we add Section D, we'll probably, you're suggesting that we'll add how many more?
Well, I'm guessing between 5 and 7,000. All you're excluding, as I understand it, it would be the gifted
right.
And talented.
That's what the result would be.
To double the bill, then, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, I see. I guess I was a little confused. I was under the understanding at first that the 25% represented an estimate as to how many people would be 25% of those eligible would participate. That's not what the 25% represents. The 25% represents all those except D. So you're saying if you add D, then you're going to add the remaining, 5 to 7,000 additional students?
That's my best guess, Mr. Chairman.
So the that means that if we had 3,000 now and we added another 7,000, we'd be actually probably tripling the cost.
Yes, sir. The fiscal note I submitted, Mr. Chairman, for the bill in its original form, estimated $7,200,000 for all youngsters for all summer. Again, we're caught with two problems. The first is the all-inclusive definitions, so that all youngsters are eligible. And the second is the reference of fund generation to the special education schedule. So the only way I can prepare a fiscal note is on the basis of the assumption that everybody's going to participate, and it's wired to the amount they generated in FY81, which is roughly $22 million.
That's what you did to start with the $1.9 million.
Yes, sir, based on 25% of the youngsters. We don't think that many will participate, but I have no way of guaranteeing that.
Do you have any idea how many school districts won't participate? There was a discussion earlier that some
wouldn't be able to prepare or gear up, or for one reason or another, they wouldn't participate this summer in the program.
My best guess is every school district, every school district with fewer than 300 or 400 ADM probably would not offer a program. All the large districts, Sitka, Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, Mat-Su, Kenai, probably Bethel, Kotzebue, all the big municipalities would offer programs.
So that doesn't cut the numbers down significantly, is that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't think the number of youngsters that we're talking about will participate, but I have no way of knowing that, and that's the only way I can prepare a fiscal note.
Yeah, okay. Representative Rogers.
Yeah, getting away from numbers for just a minute, children with learning disabilities, the people we're adding in D, they're people who exhibit disorders in one or more of the basic learning processes. You said level, what you call level one and two. Do these people need a summer program, or is a summer we were told about how there's regression in learning abilities for the others. Is there the same problem for the children with learning disabilities?
Without representing myself as an expert in special education, my understanding is the youngsters most in need of these programs are the ones presently covered by the bill. However, according to who you talk to, the other youngsters need the program equally badly. I guess what I'm saying is there's no yes or no answer to that. It depends on the disability.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Eddie, you're welcome to join us here if you like, so you can question.
May I make a comment?
Go ahead.
It looks to me like that we're going to run into a problem that we probably should leave alone then, leave the deed out. It's my understanding that there are court cases at the present time, Mr. Chairman, that are going to force us, since we're not doing what we should be doing in the state anyway, to do this job anyhow. But I'd just like for it to be no question on it.
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
I move we rescind our action and adopt
it. We never did adopt it.
Oh, okay. I thought we had.
The motion was on the table, and
I withdraw the motion then.
Okay. I wanted to ask one question here, Steve. The Senator Fahrenkamp mentioned that she was concerned about those who have a problem, dysgraphia and dyslexia, and that's why she wanted to include D. I don't suppose there's a way to include those without including the broad category that's included in D.
You can certainly put that in, Mr. Chairman, but the effect would depend upon the degree to which the youngster has been diagnosed as being dyslexic or dysgraphic. It could be that there are dyslexic and dysgraphic youngsters who are just classified as learning disabled without having had a formal diagnosis. That would depend upon the individual education plan and the diagnosis process.
I'd like to move Brian's personal amendment. I still think it's a good idea, so we can continue the discussion on it. You know, I don't believe that adding D will impact the program as much as is indicated, because I've had some experience with, I have a child who has a learning disability, and there's no way I'm going to drag him to school this summer, you know. I mean, they're not the same as people who have more severe handicaps, and it isn't as necessary for them to be in the summer program, but I think in cases where they want to, that the opportunity should be there, and I'm not sure. I don't really believe, first of all, that I think fiscal note is already higher than it needs to be for the present program, and that adding D will not impact it that severely.
Well, that's the problem he admits to, that
yeah, I know.
He hasn't got any way of knowing who isn't going to show up for the program. So you have to count, when you figure out how much money is going to be cost, you just determine how many people are eligible.
We may be causing ourselves some problems if we exclude it.
Well, I think Betty, Senator Fahrenkamp referred to that. We might not be following the law if we don't include. First, what if we don't do the program at all? Are we in
non-compliance
some way that way?
I think if we don't include the program at all, Mr. Chairman, we're going to have a bigger supplemental was put in after the court case was finished, and we have to pay it anyway.
Right, that's what I said. I'll let you just go ahead and try and see if it's too expensive then we can.
3 years prior, that's not going to count.
Right, right.
Okay. I think we use the language to clarify that.
Wait.
I think the intent of the committee, though, is to, as soon as this bill passes, that's when the clock starts. They had a loan the day before the bill passes. They can get a loan the day after the bill passes. But once they take the loan after this bill passes, they can't get another one for 7 years.
Do that, we need to change the language.
Right. Well, so, but that's the intent of the committee, and if Milt comes up with the right language, that's what we want, right? Representative Rogers.
So anybody who got a loan from the program over the last several years gets two dips at the trough?
Basically, yeah.
Oh, okay. That's not the way I read the language, and I think Milt is right. The way it says now, if you have gotten a loan in the last 7 years, you're not eligible until 7 years after you received that loan. And I think that's fair.
Okay, well, basically changing the rules.
Mentioned it. She was concerned about those who have a problem, dysgraphia and dyslexia, and that's why she wanted to include D. I don't suppose there's a way to include those without including the broad category that's included in D.
You can certainly put that in, Mr. Chairman, but the effect would depend upon the degree to which the youngster has been diagnosed as being dyslexic or dysgraphic. It could be that there are dyslexic and dysgraphic youngsters who are just classified as learning disabled without having had a formal diagnosis. That would depend upon the individual education plan and the diagnosis process.
Senator Kearney,
I'd like to move Brian's personal amendment because I still think it's a good idea, so we can continue the discussion on it. You know, I don't believe that adding D will impact the program as much as is indicated. Because I've had some experience with, I have a child who has a learning disability, and there's no way I'm going to drag him to school this summer, you know. I mean, they're not the same as people who have more severe handicaps, and it isn't as necessary for them to be in the summer program, but I think in cases where they want to, that the opportunity should be there, and I'm not sure. I don't really believe, first of all, that I think fiscal note is already higher than it needs to be for the present program, and that adding D will not impact it that severely.
Well, that's a problem he admits to, that
yeah, I know.
He hasn't got any way of knowing who isn't going to show up for the program. So you have to count, you know, when you figure out how much money is going to be cost, you just determine how many people are eligible.
Right. We may be causing ourselves some problems if we exclude it.
Well, I think Betty, or Senator Fehrenkamp, referred to that. We might not be following the law if we don't include. Of course, what if we don't do the program at all? Are we in
non-compliance
some way that way?
I think if we don't include the program at all, Mr. Chairman, we're going to have a bigger supplemental to put in after the court cases are finished and we have to pay it anyway.
Right, that's what I said. I'll let you just go ahead and try and see if it gets too expensive, then we can.
Is there any way that we could get a better feel for what the actual cost is going to be? You seem to be at the end of your road on what kind of advice you can give us.
My best guess is a program which includes all the youngsters but the gifted would cost somewhere around $4 million max. The fiscal note, however, because of the way the bill is written, as I testified earlier, is going to be higher than that. I doubt seriously that it would cost that much. Again, my best guess is we could do it for the districts could do it for $4 million or maybe even a little less. But the fiscal note's going to have to be closer to $7 million.
Go ahead, Pat.
I certainly don't advocate including the gifted, but I would like to ask the question that if we leave the gifted out, then are those people with gifted children going to come in and sue us because their special ed kids are being left out?
By the way, I'm not familiar with the court case that's been referred to here, and could we get a reference on that to
You got that stuff up. Okay. Would you mind getting with Doug Pope after the meeting and helping him get the access to the documents? What do you think, Representative?
I'm going to ask Steve again. When you said that the fiscal note would have to show 7, yet realistically, you only think, you really feel practically it could be 4 million or a little better. Why?
Because
if you feel you can only do it for $4 million, why don't we, if we approve of it, let's approve of it and fund it at $4 million?
Because the bill, on page 1, line 16, the bill says, the Commissioner of Education may approve aid to an applicant under this section in an amount up to 33% of the state aid, which, and then it sets out the criteria. Those are fairly substantive criteria that doesn't give room for estimation. As the bill was originally written, it did not tie, as I recall, the cost to an amount generated during the prior fiscal year. It just said a school district may apply for money under this bill to offer special education programs. And on that basis, we estimated, and I think the original estimate was about $2 million.
Well, how could we rewrite it or do it? I would personally support the $4 million if we could buy the whole program. I don't think that's too much. So how would you do the paperwork to make that fit? He says he can do the job for $4 million practically, and that seems to me to be realistic, excluding the gifted.
Depends on what kind of fiscal note we approve. If we only approve $4 million, that's all they get.
And he says that's what he can do it for.
That's a guess.
Well,
but that's my best guess.
I think your guess is a lot better than anybody's I know of. I'd take your guess.
Representative Carney?
Well, on the same subject, the point I was going to make is that we, you know, just because the law says that 33% and 33% could be higher than $4 million doesn't mean we couldn't have. You know, approve this one of the $4 million, and then if it turns out that it costs a little more, come back for supplemental.
Well, they'd only have enough money to run a summer program, and if I suppose they could RP or somehow get some money from another program, but they wouldn't be able to come in for supplemental if the program ends. Representative Meekins is next, and then Brian.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think that the point made about why the fiscal note needs to show $7 million is accurate. On line 16 and 17, it says the commissioner may approve aid up to 33%. If it said he shall do it at 33%, then you'd be tied in. You'd have to show whatever that worked out to be, $7 million or whatever. If it says he may approve it up to that amount, then we're just saying that that's the upper limit, but how much the program is going to cost is up to whoever writes the fiscal note. And if you say it's $4 million, then, you know, I think you'd have the latitude to write a fiscal note for $4 million. Second point is, as the chairman pointed out, even if you wrote one for $7 million, that's just a suggestion to the committee. Whatever the committee funds, whatever the legislature funds, is the funds that are available. And as long as there's provisions, which I'm sure there are, for how you handle less than the 33%, because it says up to, wouldn't be any problem. So I don't see that as a constraint.
As I pointed out earlier, the only reason I put $7 million is that is the maximum it could cost, and I didn't want to put us in the position of having to come in and request additional funds.
Representative Rogers.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I point out that it is, under the Public School Foundation formula, it is possible to short fund that formula, as has been done by various legislative committees at various times. You know, you can go... You can, and the department has to live within whatever we fund, and there are provisions in the law for allocating a shortfall. I don't believe they could draw down on other funds. They would have $4 million per summer program, and they'd have to make it fit. And if they believe they can make it fit, I think that's a good way to go.
Okay.
Would we be in serious trouble, Mr. Chairman, if we approved the fiscal note of $5 million to still hedge your bets a little bit? And would that be too much?
What's $1 million? I think that probably the most responsible thing to do would be to take the Department of Education's best guess. And as Representative Meekins points out, it'd be pretty early in the program. They aren't going to get paid until the 1st of July. So I think you'd know pretty early what the demand was going to be, wouldn't you?
Yes, sir.
And so if it appeared that you were going to run out of money, you could prorate the dollars. And unless something extraordinary happened.
I think typically we'd handle that with advance payments, and then we would withhold a certain portion of all districts' entitlement pending a receipt of the final billing or request for payment to see if we had enough or did not have enough. And at that point, we'd prorate.
Question on that. Is there any likelihood that some municipalities would only participate if they knew they were going to get the 33%? They might decide not to if their appraiser doesn't look at some.
I think it would make a difference to a school district if it were going to have enough money to operate the program or it were going to have to skimp by. So I'm sure that would make some difference.
I have a feeling that
my district might just decide that we don't want to take a chance of losing 10% of this program, and so we won't go at all. But I don't think it's worth being concerned about. I'm willing to go at all.
Representative Buck Bolton.
Do you have an indication, anyone who can answer this question, do you have an indication how many of the school districts and RAAs are interested in conducting the summer program and their children and the population that will be involved in this?
At this time, this probably would help us estimate the fiscal note if nothing else is available.
That's part of my problem in coming up with an accurate estimate. I'm sure there are some school districts who, because of the demography or the number of youngsters involved, would probably opt not to offer a program. On the other hand, the word has gotten out, and the parents and the advocacy groups know that there's a good chance there will be a summer program available, at least with respect to state funding, and so there's going to be a great demand for those programs, even if there isn't a local interest. So it's tough to estimate between the two forces what the demand will be.
I would suggest that the application knows from double the amount and take care of that. And if there's anything else at the end of the program that needs to be taken care of up to the 33%, then they would come back for a supplement and make sure perhaps.
Representative Mickens.
Mr. Chairman, I think, I don't know why this is being handled a little bit differently, but I think what the committee needs is an estimate. How much it's going to cost to do what the committee wants to do, and whatever that estimate is what we ought to fund. That's the normal process. The money here is not as I read it, it's not the same as other kinds of formulas like revenue sharing or the education formulas. It's not an entitlement. This is talking about not what the districts are entitled to receive, but how high the commissioner can go and give them money. It's a limit on the commissioner, not an entitlement, and maybe they meant to write it differently, but I see it says that the commissioner may approve aid up to 33%. It's not saying that so-and-so district is entitled to 33% of its other allotment for these kind of programs. So it's not really an entitlement, so you don't have to, it's not a question of fully funding it or prorating it like it would be in the other kinds of entitlements, as Representative Rogers was pointing out. Even if it was, we could still prorate it, but it's not even a question of that. It's just, here's a program, there's an upper cap to it, but the question the committee's interested in, I believe, would be how much is it going to cost, and we just fund that amount. It shouldn't be any problem, unless the guess is incorrect.
Do you have a response to that?
I guess the only response I can make is that it didn't make much sense to me that if a district were in a position of being required to offer a program during the summer, that it applied for anything less than the maximum to which it would otherwise be entitled. That, again, is the basis.
The
question, Steve, if the district applies, and then you're not going to know until you get them all, and if you have more applicants than to meet the money you have, could you not at that time, in a bank which applied for a $1 million program and you only had 90% of it, you could say, all we can give you is 90%, and couldn't they thereby shorten the program?
If
by
we,
10%? There's if, nothing that says how many days you have to operate it.
I suspect that would work one of two ways. If we knew at the front end that we didn't have enough, we would prorate.
And tell them in advance.
Right. If we didn't know until later, we would prorate, and then we'd have to go in for a supplemental, and they'd have to carry the difference in their case.
Right,
Senator Farrington.
Mr. Chairman, I hate to come to you with a confused bill, but I have. And that's the end of that.
Do you have the original bill in the packet?
I don't know.
I don't either. So
we
Looks like we do have it.
I'd like to ask a question through the chair of Steve if the original bill would help to solve the problem of the funding. If it were put for me.
As I recall, the original bill, it would permit a school district to apply to the commissioner without any particular limit with respect to the request for funds. And it would be an application process, and the commissioner would make some determination, and it would be funded at some level. We'd have to develop some kind of review process, but yes, that would probably take care of the problem, to the extent that a problem exists.
Which part of the original bill you referred to? Then?
In the original bill, Mr. Chairman, we did not have the former thing that happened to it as it went through the process of the committee meetings. And personally, as long as the department can handle it, I could care less whether it's the original bill or the amendment. What I really want is those kids to have the services we need to give them. And the committee might like to hear from one of the superintendents who is, or one of the people who is involved with the court cases. But we do have a court case at present time. And we, the people, the kids who are involved in the court cases are the kids A, B, C, D, and F, who are the multi-handicapped, the handicapped, mentally mostly retarded. So that somewhere or other we've got to solve this problem. And I hate to bring it to you in this form of saying either take the original or take the one that is now or put it $4 million or put it $1 million or put it $7 million. But that decision is one that you're going to have to make. And I just want the committee to know that as long as the program's offered, I'll fight for whichever way it comes out on the other side.
Go ahead, Ray.
Well, Senator, I don't believe that it makes any difference, really. I think the committee substitute is fine in its current form. The only question is that he said that he went through a process in developing the $7 million estimate, then gave us another estimate of $4 million. I don't have any idea, and I'm not interested in cutting the program back. I'm supporting it. But what I'm saying is all we really need to know is how much is it going to cost. And you can put into there a fudge factor if there's one that's called for. Put the fudge factor in there in terms of, you know, giving a little flexibility upward or something. But all we really need to know is that. And this bill would be more than adequate to allow it to happen. I mean, it would happen. It's just the only problem we have is getting the correct estimate. My only question is whether it's $7 million or $4
million. $7 million is not an estimate. It's a straight 33% of the entitlement based upon the number of youngsters, which was an estimate.
Right. So the $4 million is really
the
closest thing we have to.
It's my best guess as to what it would cost.
So that's really what we. Does that include D, by the way, or not?
Yeah.
Yeah, it does.
Okay, then. I would say that that's all we need to know.
But even that, you know, is the. You're saying that the D would cost. Your estimate is that D would cost $2 million. Or is that what you're saying?
No, Mike. The $4 million is summer school for.
The whole works.
For all the districts, all the youngsters that need it.
A, B, C, and F, you had a fiscal note of $1.9 million. But
that's
that
right.
Was, again, that was expecting to fully fund the whole program.
Fully fund the program with maximum participation
right.
of all the kids covered in the bill.
Now, when you say four, so that was probably high then.
Yes, sir.
So when you say four, now that's your best guess for the whole works.
That's right.
So actually, it's it probably costs more than $2 million to add D.
Yes, sir.
You're going to lower the original two.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's correct.
Did you have something, Joe?
I'm comfortable to include D. And approve a $4 million fiscal note to be rewritten however you want to write it. And I'm ready to go that strong. And put D.
Just a question. Of the exceptional children, then, the only ones we're leaving out are gifted. Of the 12,000 children, how many of them are in the gifted program?
I
my best, again, I'm really not confident to come back with accurate information. My best guess is somewhere between 2 and 4,000.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, there's a motion by Carney to put to include D on lines 13 and 21. Actually, there's a motion by Rogers or Carney or both, whatever. Is there any objection to that motion? Okay, there's a motion then to approve a $4 million fiscal note. Is there any objection to that? That's approved. Senator Meekins?
Moving out to unanimous consent, we report out committee substitute for Senate Bill number 18.
Is there any objection to that? Okay.
Thank you. We're adjourned.
Thank you very much.